Hello, and welcome to Cloud9Fin, a podcast on all things leveraged finance. We follow corporate debt from issuance to redemption, credits from performing to distressed, and everything in between. I'm Jennifer Munnings, and today we'll be sitting down with Chris Osborne, our senior legal consultant, to discuss the 2023 High Yield Bonds Covenant Trends Report. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So can you give us a little bit of an overview on what this piece is about?
Sure. So this is our annual report where we look at what's been happening on bonds and specifically bond covenants. And so one of the things that we saw is really just trying to focus on European sub-investment grade bonds. We try to look at which ones have high yield covenants. So perhaps a debt covenant or restricted payment covenant. And then we look at what's been happening with the year, but also try to take a longer term view and look back at how it compares to some of the prior years and see if there's interesting trends we can pull out, something that might be useful for people to know of what might be on the horizon or what's something that they should be looking to include in their deal right now.
So what were some of the key themes that we saw?
So I think for starters, refinancings just were the dominant theme. They were, I think, about three quarters of the deals we saw in 2023. And one of the things that you tend to see with refinancings is whenever anybody's starting to do a new bond deal, the starting point on a refi is what did they do last time? And so whenever the bankers, the companies, and the lawyers get together, that's their starting point. So one of the things that tends to happen sometimes when refinancings are dominating is things don't move as much or as quickly because you already have oftentimes a starting point of the last deal. The tricky thing is sometimes that last deal could just be a year ago for some frequent issuers that come to market every couple of years and have a bunch of different bonds outstanding. Others, it could be much longer if they only have one or two bonds outstanding and this is refinancing their bond from 5 years ago. So you can see some variation in what new things they look to build into the market. I think the other thing to keep on top of is, you know, what is happening with the sponsored deals versus non-sponsored deals. Obviously, I'm sure most people who are listening to this are aware the sponsored deals tend to have a little bit looser covenants, a little more flexibility. And so sometimes for certain of these trends, it's worthwhile to break those out to see if there was some separation. Getting more specific, I think one of the main things that we saw a little bit of movement on, kind of on that theme of more flexibility for some of these sponsors, is around the builder basket deterioration. So the builder basket often rewards these companies when they do well by building up their consolidated net income to later perhaps pay dividends. And on almost two-thirds of the deals in 2023, we saw deals that had a zero floor, which basically meant even if they weren't making money in those first couple of years, it never went negative. And so as soon as they get a good year, they start to benefit from that basket right away. And on top of that, we also started to see with some of the sponsored deals, they started to include a starter amount. So it wasn't even, they were kind of already building up from a bonus period, which starts to cut across what's original fundamental purpose was. And lastly, around that is some of the conditions on when you could use it started to become much more company or sponsor friendly, as one of the conditions often was that there had to be no default or event of default outstanding at the time you would look to utilize that basket. We've started to see a subtle shift where we're seeing a little more deals where it's only a event of default, or even sometimes creating a new definition where they say no material event of default, which you could argue how beneficial that really is, because, you know, how often are companies really going to be paying dividends if there's a default scenario or an event of default scenario? But I guess the argument is if it is a technical default, they're able to still generate that flexibility. And at least they're not restricted by their bond terms, even if they might be restricted on other things.
It kind of sounds like those were quite favorable to issuers. Were there any trends that were favorable to the bondholders?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the areas we saw, I guess you could say some wins for bondholders, was in the area of EBITDA addbacks. So what that is, oftentimes a lot of these ratios are tied to what is the company's EBITDA. And what you saw historically over the years is that became much more flexible as it became adjusted EBITDA. And they started building in all sorts of adjustments into it. And some of the common ones that we started to see were around pro forma events. So for certain cost savings that might come up from synergies from acquisitions. And some of these things are quite loose, fluid, and often unrealized yet. And so what you saw were a lot of definitions of adjusted EBITDA that started to benefit and be able to increase that number, even though they were things that haven't occurred yet and questionably might not ever occur. And so what we started to see is, in a way, what we'd say is caps on how much of your EBITDA could be from that future savings, those future synergies. And in some rare cases, even future revenue. And I'd say that about half of the deals last year ended up with caps on the total amount, where only, say, 20 or 25% of the EBITDA could come from future expected savings or performance. What we also saw was some of these things, because they're tied to savings around expected future events, was a limit on when that had to actually happen by. And so I think around 3/4 of deals started to add a time frame limit. But some of those time limits are still out to 2 years. So, I mean, while there's some wins for the bondholders, they're still pretty flexible in that, you know, the company can get benefits for certain events about savings they hope will happen in the next 2 years and kind of build that into some of their ratios now. I guess one of the other things that we always get asked about, and we've seen a lot of interest, is the J. Crew blockers. I know we've done some other podcasts on this and we've written a few articles. So if you want to know what the J. Crew blocker is, I recommend that. We won't dive into it here. But we have started to see an increase in the frequency with when that's come up. And there were a little over 1/4 of the deals that had J. Crew blockers in 2023.
So it sounds like J. Crew blockers are becoming way more common. Did you notice any themes or trends into deals that were adding J. Crew blockers?
You know, that's a great question. I think that's maybe one of these million-dollar questions. We tried to dig into the data a little more to see what we could figure out. One of the things we did see is, so deals that had a higher percentage of their total assets, which were made up of intellectual property or intangible assets or goodwill, which is often the type of assets that the J. Crew blocker seeks to prevent being shifted outside the restricted group. So the deals that had a higher percentage of those type of assets as their total assets, we saw a greater likelihood that they would have a J. Crew blocker. It wasn't necessarily, I think, to the degree of increased likelihood that I maybe thought it would be when we first looked into it. The flip side of that, though, is there were a couple of deals that did have J. Crew blockers that had almost no assets that were IP assets or intangible assets. And that maybe brought down that average a little bit. And sometimes it begs the question of, well, did those deals have a J. Crew blocker because there wasn't really anything meaningful for it to block? So it was a pretty easy give by the company, and the banks can say, we got a J. Crew blocker in there for you. Maybe that's just being a bit cynical, but it was an interesting thing to kind of dive into. I think it is one of those things that we'll watch that space to see if we start to see a more concrete division of when it becomes important. I think the other thing, just to make sure everybody remembers, though, with the J. Crew blockers, is there hasn't really been a solidification in the market of what the language is. So we still see various ways that it's formulated. And so it really can have a pretty wide variety of impact on how well it does its job.
I read a 9Film article from the back end of last year that talked about how TDR Capital and the ESA brothers can't receive dividends from EG Group. This seems to take the J. Crew blocker a step further. For listeners, we'll link the article in the liner notes. So, Chris, could you unpack that further?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the thing that's it's probably one of the simpler ones to unpack, in that it almost became just a full dividend blocker. So the J.Crew blocker often seeks to prevent certain assets from being moved out so that they don't prime the existing debt. This one just full-on blocked dividends. They have other PIC debt in the structure. It's possible that it came in from some of that. But like we said, it's an interesting one to unpack. I think the article probably goes into a little more detail, so I won't take up too much time now. But I think it is one to pay attention to. And I think it shows how sometimes these negotiations on what are the covenants can go up to the last minute, as it was something that was added during the marketing phase of this deal. So it's important to see that, you know, sometimes there is pushback that the bondholders do get that is meaningful.
So let's pivot a bit and talk about wins for the buy side. Did you see any instances of successful investor pushback?
Well, so that's the segue, right? I mean, that was the example. That was one of those big wins, I think. I think that, you know, one of the other things that we did see is that the wins for the buy side were probably more limited. Part of that was of what we talked earlier about, which were the refinancings, which were driving a lot of the market. I'd say that part of because of the refinancings were driving so much, there wasn't as much new aggressive terms added into the new deals as companies came to market. So maybe it was a recognition that it still wasn't quite the boom times market as it was in 2021, that people didn't push the envelope too far. There were a few deals that did have some pushback, and you can see that in our pushback tracker, you know, and along that theme, right, where we talk about what are some wins for the buy side, some of these things that we talked about, like the EBITDA caps and the timeframes, or even the J.Crew blockers, some of these were added, you know, into the preliminary offering memorandum before marketing. So it didn't even have to be things that the buy side, quote unquote, pushed back on during the marketing phase. So, you know, I guess you could call that a win.
And is there anything else that people should be paying attention to in the high yield bond market?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other big topic that gets a lot of attention and noise and questions that we see is around portability. What that allows the owners of the company to do is sell the company without triggering a change of control on the bonds. So what it can do is it can give the owners of the company more flexibility in M&A transactions because the purchaser doesn't have to worry about replacing the indebtedness right away because it's not been triggered. The reason why I think this is something that people will be paying attention to is the M&A market's been rather subdued over the last couple of years, but portability has continued to be added into deals. I think we saw 6 sponsored deals in 2023 add portability as a feature. So there are a lot more deals in the market that could get around triggering a change of control. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what actually happens if there starts to be a wave of M&A. And a lot of the terms in the high yield bonds, as much as people try to predict, you know, what will happen and how they can protect certain interests, whether the company or whether the bondholders, you know, a lot of times that happens on the back of when things actually occur. So the more deals that actually utilize these portability features, and we've seen variations where sometimes there's ratings triggers, sometimes there's leverage triggers. So there's different ways that the flexibility has been granted to some of the shareholders of these companies. I think once we start to see them utilized, we'll see how investors feel about them and how much they think it's important to either improve that protection or if they're happy with it being a little more relaxed. I think one of the other things in terms of paying attention to is, you know, a report like this offers a useful way to kind of come back and see what has actually been happening in the market. I remember when I was in private practice, you know, oftentimes you can get caught up in the one deal you're working on for a few weeks at a time. You know, you might do 3, 4, 5, 6 deals. You come up, and if a couple of provisions kept occurring in what you did, you know, that might be your anchor for how common it is, where actually, in terms of kind of looking at the whole market, which we've done in this report, you're able to come back and kind of validate, how common is this really? Okay, that's what I thought. Oh, actually, maybe that's not as common as we thought, and it's only we had that in all our deals. So it lets you kind of sense check and make sure, you know, you're not missing out on anything. I always say FOMO has been a powerful motivator in the space here, as people don't want to miss out on either flexibility for the company and the sponsors or protections for the bondholders. So everybody wants to know where the state of the market is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, Chris, final question. Do you expect any of the trends to continue into 2024?
I mean, maybe this is the cop-out. I'd probably say all of them. I know people have been hoping for things to change and lots to turn around. I don't think so far in Q1 we've seen a whole lot change. It's been a little bit more of the same. You know, just recently there was a refi for Pinewood, and pretty much everything was the same as the last deal. You know, one of the few changes they had was they added a zero floor to their builder basket, which we talked about earlier on this pod. So I think we're going to see a little more of that. I think one of the trends that I do think will play out a bit is how people will try to maximize, I guess you would say, companies saving cash as they refinance some of these deals. So what that means is, you know, as rates have started to creep up, what we're seeing is, for the first time in a long time, when issuers are coming to the market, they're refinancing their bonds at higher than what they previously were. Where for, you know, 10 years up until a year or two ago, everything was falling. So oftentimes when you were refinancing a falling market, you want to take out that older, more expensive debt as quickly as you can. And you saw all sorts of companies utilizing the redemptions, the 10% at 103, what are the call periods? And that became super important because you wanted it gone as quickly as possible. What we're seeing now is some of these issuers, the debt that's coming up actually is quite low rate. And in some cases is even lower than what we've seen that you might get from certain government obligations. You know, and that's one of these things that we talk a little bit at the end in the piece about, is highlighting a couple deals where issuers got a bit more creative, whether it was satisfying and discharging the debt or other sorts of features. I think one of the things we've seen a little bit in this year that I think will play out is when issuers are coming to the market, and for example, QPark did this, I think a few weeks ago, they can currently come with a tender offer. And so what they'll do is they'll say, hey, you want to refinance your note, you know, we're refinancing your notes. They're not due for a year. You can have your money back now at 98 cents, or we're going to sit on the cash, or we're going to put the cash in trust and we'll repay the notes at par in a year's time. So I think how those refinancings play out practically for bondholders could be very interesting. And you could see a situation where there happen to be, there's more going into it than simply just, we're refinancing, we've repaid the old bond at par because it's due within a year, participate in our new bond, here it is. I think the other space that we'll watch out for a little bit is in the fund-to-fund transfers. You know, as we mentioned, M&A has been a bit quiet. I think people are hopeful that it'll pick up. It hasn't so far very much in Q1. Maybe it's all building up to be gangbusters in H2. But with fund-to-fund transfers, which I know has been a hot topic, as a lot of these private equity funds have held some of these companies and starting near the end, is how those get treated by the market. And so are those fund-to-fund transfers treated a bit more like a refinancing, where a lot of the terms and the trends are largely kept the same? or whether people try to treat them a bit more like an LBO, your leveraged buyout, where oftentimes the terms of those deals are treated a bit more as a debut issuance, where sponsors can shoehorn in a lot more of the new bells and whistles that give them flexibility. And so I'd be curious to see how people treat those, because, you know, there's arguments kind of both ways on how they could be treated.
These are just a few of the themes touched on in 2023 European High Yields Bonds Covenants Trend Report. If you wanted to read it for yourself, you can find the full report on ninefin.com. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today, Chris.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for all the questions, Jen.
Cheers. That's all the time we've got for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and please let us know if you have any feedback. You can reach us anytime by emailing team@ninefin.com. Check in next week to hear the latest on the U.S. markets, and we'll be back the week after that. Catch you then.